Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Later today, credit card laws are about to change, and you'll want to hear how this is going to affect you. But first, Senator Ted Kennedy is being eulogized with 3 days of services beginning today here in Boston as his body travels from Cape Cod to the John F. Kennedy Library on the shores of the city, where he'll lie in repose this evening and tomorrow. On Saturday morning, his funeral mass will be held at Our Lady of Perpetual Help Basilica here in Boston. It will be a Catholic funeral for probably the most famous Catholic in America. And today we want to take a deeper look at Kennedy's faith and how it squares with his politics. Within the Catholic community, there are those who believe Ted Kennedy should be ineligible for a Catholic service, primarily because of his support for abortion rights and embryonic stem cell research. Let's start today with Michael Paulson, who covers religion for the Boston Globe. And Michael, first of all, for those who might be saying, you know, keep religion out of the discussion, how important is it to know Kennedy's faith in order to know who he was?
Well, Catholicism is an enormously important part of the Kennedy story. Of course, Ted Kennedy's older brother broke the final barrier for Catholics in American public life by being elected president. And it's hard to remember now when 6 of the 9 members of the Supreme Court are Catholic and the Speaker of the House is Catholic and the Vice President of the United States is Catholic. But those things were unimaginable back when Jack ran for president.
Right.
Catholicism is a central part of the Kennedy family's story and their legacy. And of course, it was a big, although sometimes private, part of Senator Kennedy's life.
And what do we know about what part of his life it was?
Well, we know that he was a regular churchgoer, both on Cape Cod and in Washington. He went to Mass daily for a year after his mother died. When his daughter, Cara, was battling cancer here in Boston, he regularly visited the basilica from which he's going to be buried on Saturday to pray for healing. And he himself went to the basilica to pray for healing when he was diagnosed last year with brain cancer.
Well, you mentioned the basilica. There are a lot of questions today, and this may be hard to understand for people maybe outside of the city or outside of the Catholic faith, but a lot of Catholics today are asking, why is it at the basilica and not at the more prominent Cathedral of the Holy Cross, which is also said to be the Cardinal's church? And some are wondering if it's because Kennedy, while someone who for whom religion was obviously very important, was also divorced, had his marriage annulled so that he could remarry, was for abortion rights, and as we said, strongly supported stem cell research. Is there a sense that he's not being allowed to be at the cathedral?
No, I don't think there's any indication of that whatsoever. The Catholic Church will grant him a Catholic funeral, as it would grant to any Catholic, and it's the Kennedy family's choice about the location. My understanding is that it was Senator Kennedy's decision that he wanted to be buried out of this church, and the reason is the personal connection. He developed a relationship with this church when his daughter was ill. This is a church that is associated with the idea of miraculous healing by a lot of Catholics locally, and also because it's a very large church that can hold nearly 1,500 people. It was chosen as the site for the funeral.
Well, for those who think that Catholicism may be a monolithic faith, how do Catholics square, for instance, being of the same mind as Ted Kennedy, being for abortion rights, and being Catholic?
Look, Ted Kennedy was an enormously iconic and also controversial figure within the Catholic Church. He's from the most famous Catholic family in the history of this country. He was in sync with the church on all kinds of issues, from opposition to the war in Iraq to his lifelong passionate advocacy for the poor and for immigrants and for the disabled. But he had a huge disagreement with the church on abortion, which is enormously important to church officials. And there is no getting around that. So there were conservative Catholics who thought Senator Kennedy should not even be calling himself a Catholic, that he should be excommunicated as a result of his support for abortion rights. And that issue was one of many that he simply lived with throughout his life. He had a major disagreement with the church, as I might note, do many Catholics. Catholics in America.
Well, and we remember the so-called Wafer Watch when Senator John Kerry was running for president in 2004, and bishops, one in Colorado Springs, said no Catholic who even voted for politicians who supported abortion rights or stem cell research should present themselves for communion, and others said they wouldn't serve John Kerry. And at the time, you know, we had insight into this debate, some church leaders frustrated with Catholics who, as church leaders said, had sort of a kitchen table approach to their faith. They took what they wanted, but other Catholics saying that maybe sometimes those church leaders used the sacrament as a political tool and maybe didn't wield it as much against Republicans as Democrats. So this is obviously a debate within the faith.
Yeah, it's a huge issue for the Catholic Church in America, and most bishops, although not all, most bishops in the United States have said that it's up to the individual conscience of individual Catholics to decide whether or not to present themselves for communion. Ted Kennedy regularly took communion in Boston and in Washington. And, you know, Catholics have evolved politically, economically, educationally over the last century and a half, as has the Kennedy family, and they are now a quarter of the country's population and relatively diverse. They're divided politically, just as the country is.
Michael Paulson, religion reporter for the Boston Globe. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, while Ted Kennedy's support for abortion rights put him at odds with the Catholic Church, the Monsignor Ronald Jameson is being quoted today. He's rector at the Cathedral of St. Matthew the Apostle in Washington, D.C., and he says that Kennedy still had a deep faith that was manifested through the social justice issues he championed. And here in the Boston area, we're hearing story after story from his constituents who said he served them. We've been hearing amazing stories. Now, constituent services are part of the job for any legislator, but apparently the Senator Ted Kennedy took it very seriously. 13 of the 270 victims of the 1988 bombings of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, were from here in Massachusetts. Kennedy and his Senate colleague Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey immediately went to work advocating for the families, meeting most of them. Eleanor Bright of Dover, Massachusetts, lost her 32-year-old husband Nick in the bombing. His namesake, Nick, was just one at the time. Yesterday, we asked Eleanor what it was like to be in the room with Senator Kennedy and to work on something so personal to her with him.
You didn't feel like you were in the presence of this incredibly powerful senator. You felt like you were sitting down with someone who really felt what you were feeling, felt your loss, understood, and really wanted to help you. I never felt that he was rushed. You were the most important person. Your issue was the most important issue when you were with him. And that was incredibly comforting to know that you were being heard and that it mattered.
Did he reflect at all on how he was familiar with loss?
No, but I think you could sort of, you knew that that was not far from his mind.
Yeah. Well, by the way, do you mind if I ask, what was your political affiliation prior to this?
Well, you know, I grew up in a fairly conservative Republican home, and the Kennedys were Democrats. And so, you know, that was sort of the way it was. And I think anybody who knows me, who knew my late husband, who has been involved with any of the Pan Am families, will say that Senator Lautenberg and Senator Kennedy have been our champions over the last 20 years, regardless of how you feel politically or your partisanship. You know that El Megrahi was released on Thursday.
This is the bomber who was released from Scotland to Libya.
Yes, and it was a really difficult day for my son and for me. And I had received a lot of emails from our family group with attachments. I hadn't opened any of the attachments, coincidentally, until last night. And I realized that the letter that went to Kenny McCaskill, the Scottish justice who released this man and read the long statement on Thursday, that Senator Kennedy and a number of other senators had signed a letter to him on August 17th. And that was, you know, within the last, you know, 7 days or so of his death. And so to me, that is an incredibly powerful thing because it shows that right up until the end of his life, this issue was foremost in his mind.
Because tell us more about what the letter said. He signed the letter. What did it say?
Well, it was encouraging McCaskill to have Megrahi serve out the rest of his sentence despite his poor health. It was taking a stand once again for us.
Do you plan on trying to do something to demonstrate your feelings?
You know, there'll be so many people saying so many wonderful things and writing about him and discussing his legacy. I don't know what I could really add, other than a very grateful constituent who looks at him as someone who's gone above and beyond anything I could have imagined.
Eleanor Bright from Dover, Massachusetts. Eleanor, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Let's bring in now the Reverend Jim Wallace. He's the progressive Protestant evangelical preacher and founder of the Christian group Sojourners. He's also author of The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith in Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. Jim, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi, Robin. Great to be with you again.
And first of all, when you'd heard that Ted Kennedy died, your thoughts specifically on Kennedy and his faith?
Well, I was flooded with memories of conversations. I remember in 2004, you recall, after that election, there was a great press furor about how the Democrats had lost the so-called moral values voters. You remember that?
Right. There was an exit poll that showed 22% of voters said moral values was most important to them, and 80% of those had voted for George Bush. So the Republicans presented this as proof that they were the party of moral values.
Well, you remember it well, and of course the poll was flawed. It said, do you vote for on Iraq or economics or moral values? Well, they're all moral values,
right.
But it was apples and oranges. But that was the story, the narrative. He was the first Democrat who called me. He invited me over to the House, and he and Vicky and I had a long evening, and there was never a conversation about how Democrats should win back religious voters or what should our talking points be. It was about faith, how troubled he was that his party was being perceived this way because he was a Catholic. He was a man of faith and a Democrat, and he thought perhaps his party had failed to demonstrate the moral foundations for their convictions. So we talked about his personal faith and her personal faith, and I was quite impressed with how articulate they were about theology, about Catholic social teaching. We wrestled with the issue of abortion in particular, about poverty, how that Catholic social teaching about the least, the last, the lost, the most vulnerable, how that had shaped his entire career. So that was the beginning of a lot of conversation about faith and politics, and he was always very responsive to that discussion.
Well, and you're saying that this wasn't sort of a strategy session, you know, how do we...
Not at all.
This wasn't a marketing thing with points and graphs. How do we get these voters? This was, as you say, organic anguish. Here's how I feel. Why am I not communicating this? You say the original poll was flawed. Later polls, ultimately polls, showed that the American people did side with Democrats when questions were more specific, when they asked, for instance, not just about moral values, but do you want to help the poor? You know, they would say yes. And so I want to ask you, Jim Wallace, we just have a few seconds. We're going to take a break and come back to talk more with you, but just very briefly, do you think that meeting was the beginning of trying to maybe change the language to express what Ted Kennedy said he was already feeling?
Well, I think it was already in him. That was clear. It wasn't like this was a new idea, faith, but I think he thought perhaps I could be more explicit about that. And he was worried that if he might violate his principles of the separation of church and state. So we talked about how to invoke your faith and still respect American values of pluralism, diversity, and democracy. And it was a very helpful conversation to both of us.
We want to, in fact, hear his words on that. That's the Reverend Jim Wallace from Sojourners. Let's take a minute break and come back with more of his thoughts on Ted Kennedy and his faith in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking about the late Senator Ted Kennedy and how his faith and politics met, intersected. Our guest is Jim Wallace, the progressive evangelical Protestant preacher, founder of the Christian group Sojourners. And Reverend, you were just saying that you were meeting in 2004 with an anguished Ted Kennedy who knew he had a deep faith, but also knew that voters obviously weren't hearing that and didn't want to violate his own principles. We just want to listen to a second for to a speech that he made at Liberty Baptist College, in which he spoke about his faith, but his respect for other faiths.
I am an American and a Catholic. I love my country and treasure my faith. But I do not assume that my conception of patriotism or policy is invariably correct, or that my convictions about religion should command any greater respect than any other faith in this pluralistic society.
Jim Wallace, tell us more about that struggle that Ted Kennedy seemed to have.
Well, first of all, imagine Ted Kennedy speaking at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. This really shocked a lot of people. It was a courageous thing to do, and we posted that whole speech on our website yesterday. It's amazing to listen to again, which I've done. He called for a real respect, a real listening to each other, and not attacking the moral character of those with whom you disagree, something that we could do well to listen to right now in the middle of this health care debate. But he talked about the integrity of faith and that people of faith might reach different conclusions about policy issues. And that was okay and good and should be respected. He was a New Englander. And New Englanders, you know, as they say, don't wear their religion on their sleeve like folks do maybe in the South or the Midwest. Yet, from that conversation we had in 2005 on, 2004, after the election, he really felt, you know, it might be possible for me to speak more explicitly about my faith while yet respecting that vital principle of the separation of church and state. He was committed to the diversity of religion in this country, and so am I, and that religion has no monopoly on morality. And yet King was able to, and now Obama does, invoke Jesus, Isaiah, Jeremiah, for example, without violating that principle. And Kennedy, I think, was moving in that direction, too.
Well, and President Obama met with conservative, although probably moderate conservative, evangelicals like Joel Hunter of Florida in putting together the Democratic platform on the abortion issue, changing the language.
I was deeply involved in that conversation with Joel, and, you know, there was a real, I was quite impressed, a real influence from the faith community. So we reached really a kind of a good middle ground that abortion would stay legal, but there'd be a real commitment to reduce the number of abortions in this country, which I think is a common ground that many people pro-life and pro-choice are now embracing, a practical, solutions-based approach and not the shouting at each other.
Well, Reverend Wallace, it sounds as if, especially in that evening that you spent with Ted and Vicky Kennedy, that there was almost a sort of confessional moment happening as well. And we're just wondering, what would you say to people, and maybe from that conversation or other conversations that you had with him, who might be wondering, did he address other issues about being a faithful man, that he was divorced, that he had a marriage annulled, that we've talked about being, for abortion rights, even though perhaps as a Catholic, personally against abortion, that he had a terrible, terrible accident in which a young woman was killed. Some people might say that for that person to cloak themselves in Catholicism or call themselves a religious man might make that person a hypocrite. And I'm just wondering, did he talk about, his own use of religion as redemption?
Well, you know, Robin, I have some experience with politicians who are trying to persuade me that they're getting religion, and I can tell a staffer has put some talking points in front of them. It wasn't like that at all, this conversation. Faith is about redemption, and I think Ted Kennedy's life shows that. He had serious moral shortcomings, and he admitted to those. He had issues that really needed changing. I think Vicky was just powerfully instrumental in the turnaround in his life. But, you know, it's how we respond to the broken places and our shortcomings that really is often a test of faith. I mean, I'll just sit here and say none of us are perfect, and we all have serious issues to deal with. But faith is about transformation and second chances. And I think since he and Vicky got together, there was a real stabilizing and anchoring of his life, a real focusing of his purpose, his moral purpose. I think his personal life became more in sync with his public commitments. And I think, we talked that night deeply personally about issues of faith and how much it meant to them and the struggle over the abortion issue. He and I might not have voted the same way on some of the bills he voted on there, but, you know, he voted consistently for poor people. That's a biblical issue, too.
Jim Wallace, and as we heard, some in the Catholic Church are saying that his work through social justice issues was a deep practice of the faith. But in just the minute we have, in the last few days, we're hearing people from the extreme right, politicians, talking about about these loving Ted Kennedy, these friendships they had, despite being of completely different faiths and different political beliefs. And this was going on in Washington, and yet across the country, there's never been a bigger divide. What would Ted Kennedy, what can happen? And I'm sorry, we only have a minute for you to explore that.
Robin, some of the most sorrowful people in this town are Republicans. He was perhaps the fiercest liberal in the Senate, yet he won the respect, the trust, the friendship, and the love of so many on the other side. Ted Kennedy understood the power of personal relationships. I've heard story after story of what he did for people when their parents died, when they got married, when their kid got sick. Here was a man who knew how to reach across the aisle. With all those who are yelling and screaming at him now, he probably wouldn't have been defensive and angry. He probably said, "Let's sit down and talk about it." And I love that about Ted Kennedy. Here's a guy that was so clear and passionate about his commitments, and yet all across town, people say, "I'm going to miss somebody who really tries to listen respectfully to the other side and get something done and not just keep shouting at each other about what's not right."
Perhaps people hearing that will, in the last couple of days, will do something to smooth the divide.
So. I pray so.
The Reverend Jim Wallace, founder of the Christian group and magazine of the same name, Sojourners, talking to us about the faith of the late Ted Kennedy. Reverend Wallace, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Great to be with you.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. White House science advisors are expecting that swine flu could sicken up to half the U.S. population this fall and winter and kill 90,000 people. And they continue to warn that H1N1 is more likely to kill children and young adults. So as students move back into dorms, what's the swine flu picture on college campuses? Already nearly 400 college students, mainly in the South, are sick. Students at the University of Illinois in Urbana were urged to come to campus with their own thermometer and a week's supply of food. Dr. James Turner is president of the American College Health Association. He also directs the Student Health Department at the University of Virginia. Dr. Turner, at UVA, we understand the plan for students is check in with the infirmary by phone if you feel sick. But we understand also you don't have the space that other universities do to then send students to isolation dorms. So what are you telling students to do?
If they have a roommate, we're asking our residence hall advisors to find a room on the same hall where a student can drag their mattress and their laptop and perhaps their iPod down and crash for a couple of days while the sick student is recovering. We also have a team of volunteer students, flu buddies, if you will, who are going to help deliver food and medications to the ill students. So we're relying on students to help one another during this process.
How would you place this fear of swine flu? Put it in some context for us. We remember the mononucleosis scares of, the 60s and 70s. How serious is this?
Well, at this point, it's not serious. We're likely going to see thousands of otherwise healthy people come down with a miserable case of the flu for 3 to 4 days. And as long as they don't have some sort of underlying ailment like asthma or heart disease or diabetes, they're going to recover uneventfully. I've got a couple of concerns. One is I fear that we're going to miss other causes of fever when we're seeing lots of people with swine flu. We're going to become complacent and attribute all fevers to swine flu when, in fact, we may be missing mono, strep, urinary tract infections, pneumonia, meningitis, that type of thing. That's my biggest concern. Testing right now is a bit tricky. The rapid flu tests, which we use for seasonal flu, are really not very good for swine flu. Unfortunately, they have a very low ability to accurately diagnose it. If we face an outbreak, if we're seeing lots of students coming in, we will send specimens off to our state lab to have special DNA testing to confirm, in fact, that we're dealing with swine flu. But once we've confirmed it, we'll pretty much assume that any case that looks like flu that comes in subsequently is really just swine flu.
Why are college kids more vulnerable when it comes to swine flu than say, the regular winter flu?
Well, we don't know. My theory, this is a personal theory, I think it has more to do with their living, learning, and social environments than their naive immune systems. In other words, older people don't congregate in large dining halls and in dormitories. We kind of hang out with our significant others or small groups of people, whereas these young people cluster in highly densely populated areas. And I think it just means it's easier for the virus to transmit among that group.
And, Doctor, what about vaccinations? Are you going to provide them? They are said to become available in mid-October.
Yes, we intend to try to provide the H1N1 vaccine as well as the seasonal vaccine. We need to know how many doses are going to be available when. It's impossible to plan on vaccinating 21,000 human beings without knowing when the vaccine is available. But if it is available, we're going to try to get it and do some mass vaccine clinics here using our student union, perhaps some of our large auditoriums, or even some of the athletic facilities.
Dr. James Turner is president of the American College Association and executive director of the Department of Student Health at the University of Virginia, keeping an eye on swine flu on campus. Dr. Turner, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Okay, just ahead, have you opened all that mail that seems to be coming from credit card companies? Well, you might see that your interest rate or fees have been raised ahead of new legislation. But don't cut up your old cards yet. We've got some advice for you. That's in about 30 seconds, here and now. We heard last week about new credit card regulations that took effect this month as part of the Credit Card Reform Act. You might remember that was signed into law in May. And because of new rules, card companies now have to mail bills 21 days in advance of the due date as opposed to 15 days. And they have to give customers more notice before changing their contracts. Even more restrictions are coming in February, so there's a good chance you've been getting a lot of mail this summer to give you that required notice that your rate is going up or you're being charged a new fee. And you're getting that notice ahead of the new regulations that might restrict those hikes. So what to do? Our next guest says it may be time to get a new credit card. Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Ron, you say the best revenge is a better card, but first of all, who should get a card?
Well, just about everybody, especially at a time when the card companies are trying to figure out just how many changes they can make before we'll walk. Well, it's not a half bad time to think about walking and trying to get yourself a better deal.
Would you say first call them and try to negotiate a lower interest rate? Is that really something that's going to work?
As a general rule, it works a lot of the time. For instance, if you call up the companies and tell them you're getting ready to cancel, they'll often put you through to what they call a retention specialist who, you know, will look at your account and identify just how profitable of a customer you are. And they very well may sweeten the deal for you. In fact, you know, if you just got a letter saying that they're going to up your interest rate by 3 or 4 percentage points, they may take it right back down again. And if they don't, well, then you can move on to shopping.
Okay, so let's say you want to shop around for a card. First of all, where do you do that?
Well, first of all, you have to figure out whether you are a person who has debt, or if you've never had debt and do not intend to have debt, you might be somebody who's looking more for rewards than for interest rates.
And once you figure that out, there are websites that you list. We'll have them at ours, hereandnow.org. They give you a sense of, as you write, your options. But let's just explore what happens if you do call a company and say you're going to stop your credit card, or you get another credit card. Can't they also punish you?
It can happen. And if you do ultimately decide to move and get a new card, you don't want to cancel that old one. You just want to stop using it. And the reason why that is because of your credit score. It turns out that some of your score will depend on the age of your existing account. So if you've got this card and you've been, you know, paying it back on time and you've had it for several years, the age on that account actually makes a difference. Another thing that matters is how much of your available credit you're using. So if you have, an old card that has a $5,000 or $10,000 credit line, and then you just cancel it, however much it is you're using of your new card, you'll be utilizing a higher percentage of your total available credit. And that matters to the credit scoring company because they see somebody who's maxing out or coming close to maxing out as being a higher risk.
Right. But, Ron, you know this runs contrary to what we're told, too, that if you use cards too much, you're supposed to cut them up.
You can cut up your card without canceling your account, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you cut up your card, then you're not as tempted to use
it. What about if you do get a new card and keep your old one? We understand the issuers of your old card, you write, can cut your credit limit, and that can hurt your credit score.
You know, I heard about this from a reader who wrote in this week, and the minute that she got her new card, the old card company, you know, with the card that she wasn't going to use anymore, cut her credit limit, and they said it was because that they had noticed that she had opened this new line of credit, and that worried them. You know, I mean, there's a school of thought that suggests if somebody's opening new lines of credit, they're at a higher risk if they do it quickly, because then they could take out a bunch of debt and then immediately file for bankruptcy. To me, that is a little bit of a stretch, but that is what they told her.
What about people who are in debt and that debt's on their card? And, you know, how do you transfer it? How does that work?
Well, let's say your current card company will not give you a better deal and you want to try and move the debt someplace else. You know, it used to be that there would be a lot of stuff in the mail almost every week offering you a 0% balance transfer with no fee for, you know, as much as 12 months or more. Those deals are a little bit fewer and farther between than they used to be, but there are some 0% balance transfer offers left. And then if you're looking to make a fresh start with a new card but know that you're going to need to be in debt for at least a little bit while longer, you might want to look at a credit union. Credit unions and their credit cards tend to have lower rates than the cards that are offered by big banks. And some people think that they don't qualify for credit union membership, but you would be surprised at the number of credit unions that are out there and how broad the membership requirements are defined these days. For instance, anybody can join the Pentagon Federal Credit Union.
That's fascinating. You just pay $20?
Exactly. You would think, okay, well, you know, I'm not in the armed services and I don't work for the Pentagon, so how am I going to qualify? But for reasons known only to them, probably just to increase their membership, they let anybody who pays $20, it's just a one-time fee, then you can have credit union membership for life. And it's a pretty darn good credit union.
You also write, if you're trying to apply for a credit card and you're turned down, don't keep trying because multiple credit applications can also bring down your credit score. But what if you're someone who, as you said, pays off your card every month and is more interested in the perks? What's the best way to look at a new card?
First, you have to decide what sort of rewards are most valuable to you. Do you want just cash back, or do you want to try and play the travel rewards games? Do you want to just carry one card in your wallet, or do you want to carry multiple cards? I mean, I'm a person who keeps things kind of complicated. I have a travel rewards card that I use most of the time, but at restaurants, I use my Costco Amex because I can get 3% back there. But as a general rule, you know, if you are really interested in the topic, you want to know who's offering the best deal at any given time, I would recommend the finance forum on fatwallet.com. You know, drop the name of your card in the search box to see what the smart folks there have been saying about it.
So fatwallet.com. But what about the idea that some companies are cutting back on rewards and points? Citigroup recently started adding an annual fee to some of its rewards cards.
Here's how I feel about the changes to rewards programs that have taken place so far. I think for the most part, they have happened, you know, kind of on the edges of these programs. They haven't, you know, made them significantly worse. Maybe they've made them 10 or 20% less lucrative. But the other thing you have to think about is that the very best rewards programs, those really haven't been messed with at all. And I kind of doubt they will be. The credit card industry is still incredibly competitive. There is still a lot of profit to be won once the economy comes back. I don't think as a nation we're going to dramatically decrease our use of these vehicles. And so the card companies want to play to win, and they want the big spenders. They especially want the big spenders who are going to get themselves into trouble. And one of the ways they fight for those people is with really lucrative rewards. And the point at which they start dramatically reducing the value in their very best rewards programs is the point at which we all switch to debit cards. And I just don't think they want people to do that.
That's Ron Lieber. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Ron, thank you for helping us with our money.
Happy to be here.
Did you miss that wildly popular 60 Minutes interview with NFL quarterback Michael Vick, who talked about life in prison after his conviction for running a dogfighting ring? Well, no problem. The best parts are online.
The first day I walked into prison and they slammed that door, I knew, you know, the magnitude of the decisions that I made and the poor judgment and what I, you know, allowed to happen to the animals.
Or if you missed David Letterman's top 10 list featuring Britney Spears on what she would do as president, it's online too.
Here we go, number 10.
I'd be the first president to wear eyeshadow since Nixon.
Number 9.
We would only invade fun places like Cabo.
That's right, okay. Number 8.
Free pie for everybody.
Free pie for everybody.
Michael Jackson, Rachel Maddow, reality TV mom Kate Gosselin, they're all part of the clipification of TV. People watching online sort of the Cliff Notes versions of shows instead of the real thing, something that exploded during the 2008 presidential campaign. After all, how many people saw Tina Fey's spot-on impersonations of Sarah Palin live on Saturday night?
Let's get started. Yes, you.
Yeah, what were your thoughts on Senator McCain's debate performance Wednesday?
You know, I just thought he was great. Because the American people are angry, and John McCain is angry, too. And you can tell he's angry by the way he sighs and grits his teeth, and he's always going like, "Grr!"
Brian Lowry is chief TV critic for Variety. He recently wrote about this trend. Brian, has there been a major shift?
Well, I think what you're seeing more and more is people feel less pressure to watch programs live. They know that they have this second chance opportunity to catch up with shows or catch up with clips.
Well, the thing is, you say people can catch up with shows or clips, but it seems, you know, we've been able to catch up with shows for a while with recorders like TiVo. It seems like they're catching up more with just the best part of the show. Explain the difference.
It is interesting because there's, you know, this aggregation function that's being done for us now, because in TiVo, you do it yourself. On the web, people do it for you. You don't even have to go through the process of taping the show and surfing through it.
And we know from the rating services that people, for instance, aren't watching the nightly newscasts the way they used to, you know, sitting down at 6 o'clock or 6:30 to watch the news, but you can see some of the highlights. Here's Katie Couric's commentary after Barack Obama used the phrase "we-weed up" to describe people who are getting all, well, you know, anxious, and she sort of put it in presidential context. Let's listen.
Jackson gets credit for dead duck, Harding for bloviate, and Teddy Roosevelt for lunatic fringe. George W. Bush coined misunderestimate and called a tree expert an arbotriist. And now President Obama has introduced us all to We Weed Up.
So a lot of people went to listen to that, and they, well, we know, are not tuning as much into her show.
No, and I think that's the real interesting side effect of this that, to be honest, even the television executives haven't figured out yet, which is at the point where you know that you don't need to watch things live because there's going to be a buffet the next day online for you to sift through, do people stop watching as much? The weekend that this kind of dawned on me, I realized that I had squeezed about 5 or 6 hours of television viewing into about 40 minutes.
Right. And aren't you missing something when you do that? You're a TV reviewer.
What you are missing, aside from the sort of cohesive experience of sitting through, you know, an entire show, is maybe a discovered moment that somebody didn't think was worthy of plastering up on the web.
Right. Well, and as you say, executives are trying to figure out how to benefit from this. Hulu.com is the website that provides broadcast content on the internet for free, and they claim to have web exclusives. Now, one of the most popular clips on their site right now is a preview of the coming season of the show House. Very popular, stars Hugh Laurie as the doctor with an addiction. At the end of last season, he checked himself into a mental institution. In this clip, a psychiatrist is trying to get House to open up to other patients in the institution, but instead, he, which is in character, derides them during a basketball game. Let's listen.
House! He's on my team!
Shut up. Nobody likes you. Am I crowding you?
What?
Can't see the sun?
Huh?
Oh, no! Everything's closing in.
Okay.
He's the claustrophobic one, right?
So, Brian Lowry, First of all, I'm interested in House. Have executives figured out, okay, let's take advantage of this clip mentality and let's start putting our stuff on it?
Well, they have. I mean, I think partially they've been doing this defensively because they know people are going to be doing it anyway, so they think, why don't we get our share of it? And partially it's supposed to be promotional. I mean, if you can go online and see material for House, theoretically that'll make you more willing to go watch the premiere of the show and maybe even pull someone in who hasn't watched House before.
We should say in the clip that we were just listening to, which is essentially a preview clip of House, it's not something that's already been on, during that clip, ads were scrolling across the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, I mean, those ads, and that's, you know, right now the real tension within all of the media is how do you get viewers and readers to pay for content. And, so far the trend has been simply to try to get by with advertising, but the returns from advertising on the Internet simply aren't anywhere close to what they are from a primetime television spot.
Yeah, we understand, and that's going to stay that way unless someone can try to figure out really a number of how many people watch the things online.
That's another side to this story, which is the television networks and ad agencies are actually trying to put together a rival rating service to Nielsen right now. And it's in part because they want measurement not just of how many people are watching on TV, but how many people watch on any kind of screen, whether that's your computer monitor or pretty soon streaming video on your iPhone or cell phone.
Yeah. Well, there's got to be a point where, as you said, people are leaving television in droves, watching clips on the Internet. At a certain point, there's a mathematical explosion that's going to happen. There's not going to be any content to watch on the Internet if there's no television to steal it from. Where do you see this going?
Well, you've just summed up the real, real question, which is as that audience gets more fragmented, the content providers, the producers, aren't going to be able to make enough money off their shows to provide the content we want to watch.
Do you see television stations drawing a line in the sand and saying, no more clips? Can they possibly even do that? Can they try to charge websites for pulling clips?
Well, I think they're definitely trying to take more control over their clips. But, you know, it's very, very difficult to squeeze the genie back into the bottle. And once people get accustomed to knowing that they can go surfing the next day and find what they want to find, usually they've been pretty good at circumventing almost any means of trying to stop that.
Well, meanwhile, Brian Lowry, chief TV critic for Variety, I feel very badly that I can't stay up at night to watch Conan O'Brien, who's now The Tonight Show. But I'm thrilled that his Triumph the Insult comic dog is available in clips on the web. We've got one. Can you set this up for us? What is Triumph doing?
Triumph actually goes to visit a pet hotel, a very posh pet hotel in West Hollywood.
Where the dogs don't like the treadmills for some reason. That's Brian Lowry. We'll have his article from Variety at our website. Brian, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
You've never really used this, have you? This is just for show for the people who come here. Yes, we have a treadmill, like the dogs are going to tell them. We never use the treadmill! Oh, there it goes. Okay, there it goes. Look at them love it!